To climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek.
Oh, I'd love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio. This week on Broadway for Sunday, October 16th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Good morning. Welcome back. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
All right. For all you listeners out there, Peter is back. So we will do trivia at the end of the broadcast. I'm sorry we didn't do it last week. I got all the emails and messages about it. So you'll just have to listen. And I have to say that Peter did try to get me to pre-record the trivia, but the schedules just didn't line up. So stay tuned to the end of the broadcast. We'll hit the answer to trivia from 2 weeks ago. And then
really, isn't anticipation part of the fun? Really,
that's a lyric of Sweeney Todd, in essence. But
yes. So, Peter, you did travel over out to Minnesota and North Dakota. What did you do out there?
Well, frankly, I wanted to go to all 50 states, and North Dakota was the one I was missing. And, you know, I'm not the only person in this situation, because they actually give out certificates saying, welcome to your 50th state. You saved the best for last.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, they actually have a book you sign if you've been to all 50 states. There are plenty of signatures in it. And you get a T-shirt as well. So it is not uncommon for people to make North Dakota the 50th state. While I was out there, I had a wonderful time seeing a high school production of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. Adam Pankow directed, and what I liked so much about it was that William Barfay was not portrayed as a slob. You may recall in the Broadway production, his shirt was tucked out, all that kind of stuff, and here he wasn't. He was grossly overweight in the Broadway production. Here he wasn't. So it was very different to see a kid whose problems were medical. He does mention the fact that he has this peanut allergy. He mentions a problem with the sinus. And that was the extent of it here in that production. And I found that subtlety very good. The kids were marvelous. As I say, they weren't none of them was as eccentric as the ones on Broadway. Leif Conybear, too, didn't do very, very much with that puppet. So that was, I think, a good suggestion, too. But to see all these kids throw themselves into it was really, really something. So once again, proving that theatrical magic can strike anywhere. And so I was very glad to do that. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, I went to a production of Ragtime that was truly thrilling at Theater Latte Da, as it's called, a company that's really on the rise. They finally have their own theater, which is a refurbished old movie house. It's not totally refurbished, but they'll get there. But to see these people do this show so splendidly on a shoestring, there wasn't a car, which is something that I certainly castigated Papermill for some years ago. But what they did was use the grand piano as a car, rolling it about. He sat on the top and the put his feet essentially on the keyboard, not quite, and they rolled it around. And yes, I'd rather see a car, but this was better than having the suggestion of a car that Papermill did some years ago. But the voices were extraordinary. The characterizations were marvelous. This company really knows how to cast. They really knew what people belonged in the right places. So it really was quite thrilling to see shows there. It was really quite impressive, and I'm delighted that I can check off my 50th state. However, I haven't seen theater all in all 50 states. I've only seen it in 45. So Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, South Carolina, and Arkansas yet to come. Stay tuned.
That is great. You could let your friends at MTI know that if there's some of your favorites playing in any of those five states, you could head out that direction, couldn't you?
Sure.
All right. So the three of us got a chance to see the Roundabouts revival of...
Not revival.
Yeah,
not revival. Yeah.
I understand why you say that,
yeah,
though.
But Roundabout, yes.
I understand why you say that.
It came out of my mouth, and I was like, it's not. It's the new Irving Berlin musical, yeah. Holiday Inn. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with Holiday Inn?
Well, yeah, I mean, your gaffe is completely understandable because there's not much that's new about the show except the book, which is, to me, not deserving to be on Broadway, and I can't quite believe that it actually is. Holiday Inn was a 1942 film, I believe, that had Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby in the leads, and... it was a big hit, and it yielded the song White Christmas by Irving Berlin. And then there was a sort of a not a remake and not a sequel either, but a later film called White Christmas that was basically done because the first film was such a big hit. And that one had Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby. But this is I have not actually seen all of Holiday Inn. I have it on video, and I'm going to have to catch up with it. But the way I understand it is the basic plot is the same, is that there's this performing duo, and one of them decides that he's going to leave show business and open an inn in Connecticut. And originally, in the show version now, he's planning to be a farmer and kind of give it all up, and go back to the simple life, kind of a Green Acres kind of a thing. But then that doesn't work out very well. So then the partner shows up, and then the idea is that they're going to put on shows at this place and make it a place that people come to stay and also see shows, but only on holidays, only on major holidays. So that's the basic plot. This has been used as an excuse to throw in, oh gosh, like – two dozen almost, mm-hmm. or whatever, Irving Berlin songs, from the very famous to the extremely obscure, and from all different sources, including the original Holiday Inn, White Christmas, and there's a song from Call Me Madam, et cetera, et cetera. So I felt that until the end of the first act, that it was completely innocuous and a little silly, but I was enjoying myself. And then something happens plot-wise at the end of the first act that absolutely confused me to such an extent that I turned to the person next to me after the lights went up and asked him to explain to me what was going on. And then in Act Two, the plot and the characters become so completely ridiculous that, as I said before, I cannot believe that this quality of writing has been allowed on Broadway. I don't see the point in doing anything, doing a whatever you want to call this, a jukebox musical, a catalog musical, I don't see the point in taking famous songs and writing a new book around them if the book is going to be so horrendously bad. I don't know why they didn't just do a review. I just don't get it. So that was my reaction. There were many good things in the production, including Bryce Pinkham's performance and some of the other actors. I very much enjoyed the orchestrations. I thought the costumes and sets were lovely. But the period was fudged in many ways, and aside from the book problems. And I just... supposedly, some people have said that the only reason this was done is because when something like this happens, the songs, which are threatening to fall into public domain because they're so old, then get some kind of new rights coverage because they are used in a musical like this. this has supposedly been the impetus for some of the Gershwin redos as well, of which there have been several. So I'm not 100% sure about the details of that and or the motivation, but whether that was the crass commercial motivation or whether the motivation was completely pure, I think in this case, the book, which is by credited to Gordon Greenberg, who also directed, and Chad Hodge, is not worthy of presentation on Broadway or, for that matter, in community theater.
All right. Peter, what did you think?
I liked it a little less than Michael. So, you know, let's talk about this book. Now, we used to love at first sight at this type of musical. So having Jim and Linda experience this cliche isn't lethal. But Linda is a former performer who quit to become a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And those 16 of Jim's show business friends come up to help him put on a show every time there's a holiday, you'd think that at least one of the 8 women would take umbrage that Jim chose Linda and not one of them to be the lead. But no, they all smile and they dance happily behind her. And if that's not bad enough and unbelievable enough, Jim also features in each number his handy woman, Louise. She's a closet lesbian, it's 1946, and has never expressed any particular interest in performing. She doesn't give any indication that she's ever sung or danced, even in grammar school shows. But there she is, center stage, while the female dancers, the professionals, seem thrilled to back her up. Would you believe the pros from Manhattan would come to Connecticut and settle for chorus when rank beginners are getting showcased? I mean, it's just, you know, just crazy. By the way, I'm not really certain if this Holiday Inn is only open on holidays or they only do shows on holidays.
I think it's supposed to be the latter.
Yeah, it better be, because as an old hotel employee who's checked in everybody from Marilyn May to the Supremes, I can tell you that business on holidays is pretty lousy. And I don't know what kind of business plan there is when you're only open on holidays. I believe the movie indicates that the inn is only open on holidays. Well, whatever the case, I mean, there's no question that the movie of Holiday in 1942 gave Kemmons Wilson down in Memphis an idea for a hotel chain that certainly has done well. But I'm reminded of something that was said in a play called Steam Bath that Bruce J. Friedman wrote in 1970. It took place in hell, okay? One character says that she often assumed that death meant you'd have to spend every day of your life in a different Holiday Inn. That's what she thought hell would be. Well, yeah, the show at Studio 54 isn't remotely that hellish, but it does have so many liabilities that the line does come to mind.
What Peter has just said merely scratches the surface of the ridiculous things that happen in this book. Initially, at the beginning of the show, Jim Hardy, played by Bryce Pinkham, and Ted Hanover, played by Corbin Bleu, who, by the way, is charming in a horribly written role. They are a team. They're a performing team, and Jim is basically the singer, and Ted is the dancer. So then Jim, Bryce Pinkham, is the one who decides to give it up and go and start this Holiday Inn. And this leaves Ted to perform with the woman who was the third part of this performing team, Lila Dixon, played by Megan Sikora. And so they are performing together, and at one point they're offered a screen test that we have the idea that one of the studios, which is actually Universal and is named, and we actually see the logo, so I guess they have some money in this. They are going to make big stars out of them, and especially out of Ted. But then Lila winds up leaving also, and so now Ted needs to find a new girl. And so he comes to the Holiday Inn to find a new girl to be his dancing partner. And we're supposed to believe that it's completely up to him to find a new dancing partner and that she will then be able to do this Hollywood screen test with him. I don't think that's really kind of what would happen. And then there's stuff at the end where Lila and Ted wind up making a film about the Holiday Inn in which they play Jim and Linda. And we see the clip of this film, and the acting in it is so horrendously bad that the audience laughs. But it's like, to me, that's just another sledgehammer, you know, how stupid do we think the audience is situation. To, you know, why would Ted be that bad an actor? Or why would Lila, for that matter? It's just ridiculous. One incredibly silly thing after another happens in the book, and I'm just trying to forget that I ever saw it.
And another thing. Why must musical comedies insist that young women who portray chorus girls have screechy, silly voices?
Yes, yes.
Must they act as if their brains are on a permanent leave of absence? Yes. I mean, you mentioned Lila Dixon, who's appearing at a club called the Cat's Meow, which, by the way, this musical is not. Anyway, during the opening number, after Bryce Pinkham and Corbin do their very nice hoofing. Oh, by the way, the choreography is terrific. We have to give Dennis Jones some credit.
Thank you.
There are some nice things there. And if he doesn't get a Tony nomination, well, we are going to see four amazing choreographic displays this season. So anyway, the choreographer parts the ensemble like the Red Sea, and they're far upstage. Back to us for only a second is Lila, who spins around, and she doesn't get any applause. And it's a star entrance, but Megan Sikora isn't a star yet. Good luck to her. You know, I'm not saying that she won't be, but at this point, the audience can't be expected to treat her as one. But anyway, after the number, Lila speaks of that low-class delivery that the director, Gordon Greenberg, thinks will amuse an audience.
Mm.
But the problem is, we find out she's engaged to the man on that stage we're most supposed to care about, and that's Jim. That he wants to be the husband of such a bubblehead makes us lose immediate respect for her. So I think that's a real problem, too. I guess we can blame this on Guys and Dolls in Adelaide, the screechy chorus girl. Maybe it was before that, but that's what first comes to mind when I see this, that so many people try to do things in her image. And
yes. Also Born Yesterday, but in both of those cases, the original performers were so brilliant that
sure. All right.
So just a few things. I don't disagree with anything that you guys have said so far. My wife brought up those points immediately, saying, what did I miss here? Why are these characters painted with such a broad brush, and are we not supposed to like them? And why is this Charlie Winslow boy even in the show? It's so out of left field to see.
Oh yeah.
The pre-adolescent who works for a bank.
Yeah, and then gets fired and works for the Holiday Inn, and it's so put together from yesteryear. And as Michael supposed before, that Universal Pictures is actually one of the producers of this with Roundabout Theater Company. It's Universal Stage Productions, Universal Pictures, who has produced things like Wicked, Billy Elliot, Bloody Bloody Interjections, the revival of Sideshow, and now this. And they are doing grosses of about $400,000. So this is going to be a little bit of a struggle. They're open for 6 weeks and their high is $404,000 in grosses, with their low being $165,000 in their opening week.
Thank you for mentioning Dennis Jones, though, Peter, because his work is stellar. There is for what it's worth, there is a true showstopper in Act One, Shaking the Blues Away, full ensemble dance number that really
that was the
one time I felt the audience was really 100% with this show.
Yeah, that was really great. And y'all haven't mentioned Laura Lee Geyer, who I just adored in this thankless role.
Yes, I think I agree. I think she did as much as anyone could possibly do with it. And she sang beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she, I'm looking at IBDB, she was in the Revival of Follies. She did Dr. Zhivago a few seasons ago and now Holiday Inn. So hopefully we'll get her into in something new coming up. All right, next up, Peter and I got a chance to see Heisenberg. Michael, you're going today, aren't you?
Yes.
So Peter, why don't you tell us about what you thought of Heisenberg?
Yeah, a chance meeting between a 75-year-old man and a 42-year-old woman. So there they are. And, you know, it's sort of like when you're on a plane and the person next to you feels like talking, you don't feel like talking, but you feel you want to be polite, and suddenly you're really drawn into a conversation that you really don't want to have. That's what happens here to this poor man, this 75-year-old man, who really is not interested in doing anything with this woman whatsoever. That will change, but at this point in time, poor Alex Priest is essentially being assaulted, verbally at least, by Georgie Burns. Now, does she have an agenda? As we find out in this very short play, about 80 minutes, written by Simon Stevens, the gentleman who wrote Curious Incident, well, as we find out, she does have an agenda, but by the time she tells us her agenda, we are a little more interested in her, and we do think that she may very well be sincere, and that isn't just the agenda, that what she wants from him, which is sizable, by the way, what she wants from him is the only reason that she's interested in him. Little by little, he gets seduced by her, but not in a way that becomes obsessive for him or obsessive for her. We get the impression that at any given moment, he might leave, she might leave. So there's the suspense in the play. This is an okay outing in the theater in terms of script. And Dennis Arndt is very good as Alec Priest. But my Mary Louise Parker as Georgie is sensational. If you've ever seen a Mary Louise Parker performance, and I dare say you have, be it in the movies or on stage, you're going to be really impressed, because she really nails this character. Who's a bit on the low class side, a bit of a scatterbrain. And watching her make this woman come to life is the real strength of seeing Heisenberg. Now, one has to wonder. I once did a study of plays that won Tonys, and the next play that was produced by that same playwright, and how those plays did. And it's really amazing how plays that won Tonys average about 700 performances each, while the second play produced immediately following the Tony winner turns out to write about 100 performances each. And I've always suspected that it's a case when a playwright has a big hit, especially a Tony-winning hit, that what happens is producers say, "Hey, what else you got?" And they pull out something from their drawer that was never produced, an earlier play, and say, "Here." And the people say, "Well, this is by the guy who wrote the Tony-winning play. This must be just as good." "Yeah, yeah, we'll do it." I'm not saying this happened here. I have no knowledge whether or not it happened here. This might have been something he started after Curious Incident. But all I can say is that came to mind while watching Heisenberg, because it didn't certainly have the power of Curious Incident. Now, it may be a little unfair to compare both plays, because, after all, who says that a writer has to write the same type of scope every time he sets out? Certainly Curious Incident's goals were on the 9 to 10 scale, while this one here is 4 to 5. But this is a different type of play entirely, a type of romantic comedy on an angle. So still, it's worth seeing for Mary Louise Parker. I've never seen her be like this before. So it was really something to see her be consistent and to be excellent at every turn, making you believe, yes, that's exactly what that woman would do at this point in time, exactly what that woman would do in this new situation. And so I applaud her tremendously, and I hope she's remembered at awards time.
I was thinking to myself, I saw it last night, actually, and I kept on going back and forth, and even right now during this conversation, back and forth whether she was calculating or crazy. I'm a big fan of hers from way back, from Prelude to a Kiss Time, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting to see her on stage. Did you mention Dennis Arndt?
Yeah, I think he's very good.
Yeah. I mean, it's a minimalist staging with 200 some odd seats on stage in stadium seating, an interesting sort of theater and around with a proscenium.
Well, you know, and that's kind of clever too. Yes, indeed. So all these people do are on a very narrow strip of the stage right at the front. Now, I love when directors put people right downstage tremendously, right at the lip of the stage. That's my favorite type of staging. Let's see them. And this makes it very clear. But what occurred to me, too, is the fact that because there's that stadium seating on stage, that all of a sudden you don't have to have a set. Do you? There is a scenic design attributed to Mark Wendland, but all there is really are two tables and two chairs, which function in various ways, including a bed. But this is a way of doing shows a bit on the cheap, isn't it? And not only that, you get that extra bonus of having these people on stage paying money, 100 seats, 200 seats, whatever it may be. But they're paying money to be up there. So you're saving on a set and gaining in gross. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is a wave of the future that we're going to see this because it is a way to save money and make money.
Yeah, we saw a handful of productions last season with seating on stage as well.
This one has the least amount of stage and set of any exactly. that has, you know. So that's the difference. And I do think we're going to see more of these.
It's a new production of the Fantastics for community theaters to do two people and no sets and an intelligent script. So next week we'll hear from Michael and let us know what you think about that, and let us see if you agree with that.
Yeah.
Next up, Michael and Peter got to see Tick, Tick, Boom. So why don't you both tell us about that? Michael, why don't you start?
Sure. If it's okay, I thought I'd read actually from Wikipedia because the genesis of the show is so interesting and it is completely correct what they have here. I was very much a fan of the original production. So anyway, Tick, Tick, Boom is a musical written by Jonathan Larson, and it tells the story of an aspiring composer named John who lives in New York City in 1990. John is worried he has made the wrong career choice to be part of the performing arts. The story is autobiographical, as stated by Larson's father in the liner notes of the cast recording. Larson had been trying to establish himself in the theater since the early 1980s. He began to perform the piece as a solo work in 1990. After his death in 1996, it was revised and revamped by playwright David Auburn with the music, vocal arrangements and orchestrations, by the way, by Stephen Aremus, as a three-actor piece, and was premiered off-Broadway in 2001 and appeared off-Broadway again in 2014 and now again in the Keene. This wonderful Keene Company production at Theatre Row. Since then, the show has had a London production, an American national tour, numerous local productions, and it was also very notably done at Encores as their part of their off-center series just a few years ago with Lin-Manuel Miranda basically playing Jonathan Larson. The Tick, Tick, Boom was originally produced off-Broadway in September 1990 at the Second Stage Theater and New York Theater Workshop and the Village Gate in 1991. Larson performed the show as a rock monologue, a new form of theater for the time. The performance attracted the attention of a young producer named Jeffrey Seller, who became a fan of Larson's work. In 1995, he saw the New York Theater Workshop production of Larson's musical Rent and convinced his fellow producers to bring it to Broadway. After Larson's death in 1996, producer Victoria Leacock asked David Auburn, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Proof, to reconfigure Tick, Tick, Boom. Auburn restructured the monologue into a three-actor musical with one actor playing John and the other two actors playing Michael and Susan, as well as the other roles in the show. Also, the script and score were streamlined and edited. The revised version of the piece premiered off-Broadway at the Jane Street Theater on May 23rd, 2001, which I very much saw with Raul Esparza and Jerry Dixon and Amy Spanger. They were the original cast of the original production. It was absolutely wonderful. To me, Tick, Tick, Boom has always been a very moving show on several levels. First of all, there's the subject matter itself, this early midlife crisis of basically Jonathan Larson himself, working away, writing all this wonderful stuff, trying to get it produced, trying to get people to see it. And he is not sure how long he can keep going. He's only 30, but he thinks of that as this kind of a milestone in his life, and is hoping for some kind of affirmation. It's complicated by the fact that his girlfriend Susan is a dancer, but she decides she's going to maybe give it all up and move to Cape Cod, and she wants him to come with her, but he really is not sure he's ready to give up yet. So that's moving to begin with. Then, of course, the fact that Jonathan Larson died right before the Rent premiered, and the incredible tragedy of that, which in retrospect, that tragedy that exists in retrospect. Then on top of that, AIDS figures into the story of this show, because John's friend Michael winds up getting AIDS. And so that, is very, very moving and affecting in itself. And then on top of all that, the show, the original production, was running in 2001 and was running – it was running at the time that 9/11 happened. And I'll never forget, as I've said before, the original cast recording, a release party for it was to have been held on the night of 9/11 that I was had been booked to go to, which obviously didn't happen. So all of that together, it's really, really moving and affecting to watch this show. I started crying during the song Why, which is an incredibly beautiful and moving song about how John, why he does this, what it is that keeps him writing for musical theater. And it's really just one of the greatest songs ever written. But there are several other moments in the musical that are very moving. There is an actual song from the actual show called Superbia that John is writing and workshopping at the time of the action of the musical. And that song is called Come to Your Senses. And it's performed here by Ciara Renee as Susan. Jonathan is played by Nick Blaymeyer in this King Company production. And Michael is played by George Salazar. And I just think that everyone who cares about musical theater has to see this beautiful production of this incredibly great show. David Auburn and Stephen Arimus did a magnificent job in restructuring what was originally a solo piece as a piece for three actors. And I think it's a great tribute to the legacy of Jonathan Larson. If you have seen the show before, I think you will be delighted with this production. Nick Blaymeyer is absolutely fantastic as Jonathan. And I felt like he really got into the skin of Jonathan Larson. If you have never seen the show before, this would be an excellent, excellent place to start. It's playing at Theater Row in the Acorn Theater, and I could not recommend it more highly. It's directed by Jonathan Silverman with choreography by Christine O'Grady and musical direction by Joey Chansey.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Well, let me also say that, yes, the album was coming out on 9/11, and a young actor I know decided that he would go into work late that day because he would go and buy the album first when we used to have record stores, and then he'd go to work. He worked in the World Trade Center. If the album had not come out that day, he would have gone to work, and he would have been in the World Trade Center. So Tick, Tick, Boom actually saved a life, which is kind of poignant and interesting for its own sake. Well, I agree with Michael that this is really quite a good production. Nick Blamire even looks a little like Jonathan Larson.
Yes.
You know, not a lot, but a little, and more than anybody I've ever seen. And he really steers this ship tremendously well. So he is magnificent in the part. No other word will do. The show is also very inspirational in a number of ways. And I'm thinking of a young woman from Ohio that I know who came to New York to become an actress. It didn't work out. Went to Chicago to become an actress. It didn't work out. Decided that she would go back home to Ohio and try her luck there and hope for the best. And has had a tough time of it. And, of course, the idea of giving up has occurred to her, too, of course. And I say the problem with giving up is that when you give up, that phone call that rings in your apartment, that emails that you're checking today, will never have the news that you want it to have. No matter how much money you make in another field, you will always be haunted by the fact, you know, if I just stayed with it, I bet I could have made it. Now, one of the things that's important in this show is that Jonathan's friend Michael has, I don't like the term sold out. That's really not fair. I mean, but let's say he has opted to stop acting and go into the world of corporate finance. And now he's making a lot of money. And also he has a wonderful car and a beautiful home and all that. And Jonathan has none of that. And there is a song that really indicates a great deal about living in an apartment where you have to throw down the key for people to get in, and people who know rent. And don't we all know that that's an important part of the show, that we hear that happening. One of the interesting things about Tick, Tick, Boom is that you see little seeds of rent happening, little things that happen that that you find show up in Rent. And while they don't make a didactic statement like Jonathan looks at us as the orchestra plays a little bing, you know, while he looks out at us and say, wow, I could use that in a musical someday. Those of us who know Rent know that those things did show up in Rent. So there's a lot of seeds planted in the show, and that's kind of fun, too, for all the Rent heads from way back when, who I bet saw Tick, Tick, Boom because it was still running concurrently with Rent. And but it might be a nice nostalgic trip back for those Rent heads who want to be reminded of what they felt 20 years ago suddenly, which is amazing. So all in all, it's an inspirational show. People who are in the business who are thinking of giving it up may get a lot of courage from seeing this show. The other factor that has to be mentioned, it's so sad when you realize that Jonathan is really freaking out about turning 30. And we know that his life is 5/6 over. He doesn't know that, but we know that. And it's one thing to be freaking out of turning 30 when you expect that you're going to live to your 70s, 80s, and 90s. But when we know that that's not going to remotely happen, that becomes even more of an issue. So, yes, I agree, Michael, a tremendous production. This is the sixth one I've seen, and it's the one where I thought was the most successful, and that even includes the original. All things considered, I think it really is worth going to. It may seem to you like too familiar a title. It may seem to you like, that famous statement that people really aren't interested in the trouble troubles of people who are in show business. Yeah, but I think all of us can appreciate a struggle, and that's what we're seeing here. And the inspiration at the end, I don't think there's so many times exposition is set up by phone calls, but rarely are shows culminating with phone calls, but that's what happens here. A phone call turns out to be very important in this show, and it's not an irrelevant one. So under those circumstances, I agree with Michael. Go to Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. That meme or whatever about people not being interested in the struggles of people in show business, I guess that one would think that a chorus line would have put that to death alone a long time ago. But people do still keep saying that sometimes, don't they?
Well, and the thing with chorus line, of course, is that it was a case where everybody related to the fact that we've all auditioned, even if we're not in show business. They're called interviews when we're trying to get a job.
Sure.
So that, you know, really helped chorus line along too. But I do believe that the inspiration here is just as strong about don't give up and keep going, and you must. So and while, of course, success doesn't come to all people, there are various degrees of success, and you can be happy if you get close to your dream. And I think people realize that. Oh, you know, something occurred to me. I was playing Cabaret the other day because it was literally the 50th anniversary of my seeing Cabaret in Boston, the tryout. So there was Fred Ebb's lyric that I've always thought was so brilliant. And you learn how to settle for what you get. And I've thought, wow, you know, Fred Ebb was a reasonably young man at that time. And for him to know that, you know, maybe that comes from the Berlin stories. I don't know. But you learn how to settle for what you get. And suddenly, after 50 years, something occurred to me. And that is, and you learn how to appreciate what you get as well. And under those circumstances, this applies here because, indeed, if you get close to your goal, you will appreciate what you did get. And if you're working in the field in any way, shape, or form, you're still better off than going to a job where you have no interest and you're just going for a paycheck, because that's the type of death as well. So by all means, keep going, everybody out there. It may pay off as it did, at least for Jonathan's heirs.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, absolutely. The larger point is that whatever your dream is, whether it's show business or math or botany, you know, I think everyone can relate to the struggle and the question of how long to hold out, you know, before you give up or if you're going to give up. And yes, it's I think maybe Tick, Tick, Boom is unique in that I can't offhand think of a show that is so sad and inspirational at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because most of the reason why it's sad is because of what happened in life, which there was no thought of that at the time that it was written. So there's this all these levels that are happening. But I, whatever the reason, I did cry, and I I knew I was going to, but that you know, so. I didn't surprise myself in that sense.
Peter, I am. I wonder for those who have never auditioned but as you mentioned, do have the interviews in life, and whether they're going in for an interview with a large company or a small company, none of them ever feel the stress of am I singing the right song at this interview? So.
Yeah, but are you saying the right thing? You know, there was the articles about the things not to say when you go in an interview, you know, and there were so many of them, and it's hard to keep them all straight. So, as Nikos Kazantzakis said, life is hard, even the luckiest life.
And there is a hysterically funny moment in Tick, Tick, Boom. I do not want to indicate that there is no humor in it, because that's not true. But John, Michael convinces John to come to his work and be part of a brainstorming session for it, because he works at an advertising company. And I won't say any more, but the way John acts during this brainstorming session and the thing he winds up saying is so hysterical that the audience was just in stitches. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move forward. Peter, you got over to the Roundabout Theater Company's production of Love, Love, Love. So why don't you tell us, did you love, love, love it?
I liked it. and you know, the thing I was talking about earlier about when a playwright has a big hit, suddenly other shows from his drawer show up. This may be the case here as well, because what we're talking about here is the playwright who last year gave us one of our best plays of the year, and that was King Charles III. We are talking about the playwright, Mike Bartlett, who now is going in a completely different direction. We are not dealing with regal people at all by any stretch of any imagination. The play reminded me, when it started out, of a Peter Schaffer play called The Private Ear. Because what we're talking about is a gentleman is having, well, I don't know if we'd call him a gentleman, I mean, but anyway, a guy is having his girl come over to his apartment, and his brother is living with him at the time, really sponging off him, I'm sorry to say. And under those circumstances, the brother who has the girl coming over definitely wants him to leave before she gets there. And for one reason or another, and reasons that may not seem to you terribly convincing, he finally says, all right, you can stay, but don't say anything. Go, you know, go in your room and all this kind of stuff. And, well, aren't I just going to say hello? Well, anyway, it leads to so much more than that. And eventually what happens is that there is a struggle for the girl, who is played by Amy Ryan, who is sensational beyond belief in playing this young flippity-gibbet who has the funniest reactions to what's being said and mostly what she's saying herself. She has this wonderful way of not quite laughing, but looking as if she's laughing without making a sound that is both hilarious and endearing. So I really think that seeing the show is worth it, just seeing it for her. Now, I'm not going to give up too much away here, because I even fear I've given away too much already. But the point is, this is a 3-act play. It's not that long. You're out after 2 hours and 15 minutes. But some of that reason has to do with 3 different sets. Yes, but it also has to do with 2 other time frames. And that is, we see 2 of these characters 20 or maybe 25 years later, and what they're doing is living a life with 2 children who are teenagers, who are difficult teenagers. Or are they? Part of the point of the play is that parents today really don't give enough attention to their children, that they're so absorbed with their own lives that they will not sacrifice for their children or take their children as seriously as they might. That's the real theme of the play. And it continues in the 3rd act, which takes place about maybe 20 years after that. And there's no indication in the program how many years have passed, by the way. You have to pick it up through cultural references. I mean, for example, in the 1st act, you know that it's a while ago because they're talking about the Beatles being on TV right then and there. Okay, so now we know we're in the 60s because the Beatles broke up in 70. So there are little touchstones like that. There's no projection giving you the year. You have to figure it out for yourself, but it's not hard to do. But anyway, it shows what happens over time. And do these parents straighten out and wind up really caring about their children as much as they might? No, I'm afraid they don't. But that's the point of the play. The parents should really be more attuned to their children's needs if they're going to be parents in the first place. That it's not just enough to give birth and say, well, you've got to do it on your own. Kids need help. And that's what is sorely lacking in the characters. So Mike Bartlett has done a good job. And it's not a play that is really as compelling as you might think, but it makes its points quietly. And what's really nice is the acting, because in addition to Amy Ryan, certainly Zoe Kazan as the teenage daughter and later adult daughter is very skillful both in both the acts that she appears in. So I also very much like Richard Armitage's Kenneth, who is the brother who won't leave in the first act, and we'll see more of him. So, it's at the Laura Pels Theater, that nice space downtown across from the school that used to be the Fame School. So it might be worth going down the steps to see the play, but it's certainly worth getting there to see Amy Ryan, who gives one of the finest performances of the season.
Wow.
Excellent. Michael, are you going to see Love, Love, Love?
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
I will also see it, so maybe we'll talk about it again in the next couple of weeks.
I have heard really, really great things from several people, so I'm really looking forward to it.
So, Michael, you got down to the New York Pops where you did the Lerner and Lowe show, or you saw the Lerner and Lowe show. You weren't in it, were you?
No.
Good. Okay. I would be sad if you were and I had missed it, but I wrote this wrong in my notes. It said you were in it, but you actually saw it. So tell us about it.
I will say that, as I tend to mention when I go to Carnegie Hall with someone, that I did get to sing solo on that stage once. So that's always something that I like to mention, because that was a thrill. This concert was on Friday, October 14th, on the Ronald O. Perelman stage of the Isaac Stern Auditorium in Carnegie Hall, which, thank heaven, is still standing, even though it was almost torn down in like 1960. One of the great cultural institutions, cultural buildings of New York City and the world. And the New York Pops, as always, does these wonderful programs. They've been doing a lot of Broadway. I mean, they always did, but it seems to me like, especially more in the past several years, they've been really focusing on Broadway and bringing in stars from Broadway. And in this case, the guest soloists were Colin Donnell and Laura Osnes, primarily from musical theater and Broadway, and then also Nathan Gunn, who is a great operatic baritone, but has also done musical theater roles in Camelot. He was Lancelot in the New York Philharmonic production of Camelot, and he has done Showboat, and he also several other things. In recent years, he's focused more on musical theater. This was a wonderful evening. Just to hear the orchestra play the wonderful Lerner and Lowe songs from Camelot, Paint Your Wagon, Gigi, Brigadoon, and My Fair Lady, that was pleasure enough in itself. The arrangement, this concert, it was called The Musical World of Lerner and Lowe. And right at the top of the title page in the program, it says arrangements by Johnny Green. It seemed to me that at least some of the orchestrations were the originals, specifically Camelot. I really enjoyed hearing those. So I'm not sure that he arranged everything, but maybe it just also means expanding for, you know, 70-piece orchestra. Whatever, it sounded beautiful. The orchestra always sounds great. There were some, I thought, some odd choices as to who sang what. For example, although Nathan Gunn, as I said, did play Lancelot in that production of Camelot at Avery Fisher Hall with the New York Philharmonic, and although he did sing If Ever I Would Leave You in those performances, in this case, If Ever I Would Leave You was sung by Colin Donnell, and they had to bring up the key for him because he's really more of a tenor than a baritone. And I think that song really has to be sung by a baritone. So I don't think that was the wisest choice in the world. On the Conversely, Nathan Gunn sang the title song from Camelot, which is really more of a patter song. It doesn't have a lot of sustained notes, and that was not his strong point. So that seemed odd. But on the other hand, there were many chances to shine for both of those gentlemen. Nathan's performance of Gigi, the title song, was beautiful. And that's interesting because that song was not originally written to be sung by someone who had a legit voice. It was originally performed by Louis Jourdan in the film, and very well, but not a legit voice by any means. But that song is much more lyrical and expanded beautifully to be sung by a legit baritone. Nathan also shone in They Call the Wind Mariah from Paint Your Wagon, and that was a high point for the essential voices, the chorus that performed with Judith Klerman as music director and conductor. Collins' highlight for me was Come to Me, Bend to Me from Brigadoon, which Colin, even if I didn't know his last name, I would describe his voice as Irish tenor. It has that quality to it, and it has a very lovely quality in that respect. And of course, Brigadoon is actually set in Scotland, not Ireland, but the music has a very similar lyrical quality there with those beautiful pianissimo high notes that are required. So he did a great job with that. And Laura Osnes, I have to say, every song she sang was a highlight. She just sounded beautiful. Her voice is so pure and gorgeous. And her performance of the My Fair Lady songs was so wonderful that my companion said, and I completely agree, that we hope she is definitely considered when and if revival actually happens on Broadway. It's been talked about so often, including recently. And there was also talk of a film remake. I don't know if that's still in the planning stages, but whatever. I would really love to see Laura Osnes as Eliza.
Speaking of Lerner and Lowe, there's a production of Camelot right now at Westport,
yes.
The Westport County Playhouse in Connecticut, and I did go up and see it. Robert Sean Leonard is playing Arthur, and he's a little one note. The one note is right that he has, but I wish there were a few notes in his performance that varied from that. Brittany Coleman is the young woman playing Guinevere, and she really understands that lyrics aren't just made to be sung but felt, and I think she's very strong. But I'll tell you what's really funky about this production, and I don't think that Lerner would have liked it very much. I know I didn't. David Lee, basically a TV writer, has decided that revelers should be part of the cast. Now, these are performers dressed in Commedia dell'arte costumes, and they have the masks on, and they come on occasionally. They say, the throne room, you know, and they set the scene and all that. So director Mark Lammas has them spinning and twirling and fancifully bowing and all that stuff. Now, at first, they're intrusive, and you might wish they'd go away. But in the second act, they're really a liability because that's when Camelot becomes very serious. Mm. I mean, there's infidelity, there's betrayal, there's sabotage. And here are these happy-go-lucky revelers coming out and bowing and scraping and saying the throne room and other such things. And it just really doesn't work. So you talk about a My Fair Lady revival. There's often talk about Camelot being revived, too, because Camelot certainly got a bad deal way back in 1960 because it was following My Fair Lady. Mm. The real slap in the face, which I'll never understand, is that year it didn't get nominated for Best Musical. You might say, well, they didn't like it. Okay. But, you know, there were only three nominees for Best Musical that year, Bye Bye Birdie, Irma La Douce, and Do Re Mi. Really, Camelot doesn't belong in that group. They left the fourth slot blank, which is really quite the slap in the face. So despite the revelers, there's much good in the production at Westport. And if you've never seen Camelot, I do think it's worth a trip. Even though the David Lee has also cut the show down, not just to the bone, but to the bone marrow, there's a lot that isn't there. but you don't really miss it. So Lerner was famous for overriding, and you know, as Noel Coward said when he saw it in Toronto when it was 4.5 hours, it's twice as long as Parsifal and not nearly as funny. But I love that quotation. Anyway, really though, Camelot has a lot of good in it, and despite the flaws here, if you're in the neighborhood, do see this production.
Peter, the revelers, as you describe them, I haven't seen this production. Do you think the director could have made them darker and darker as the show went on to reflect it?
That's a good point, and I have to admit it didn't occur to me. I dare say they don't get darker. I know that's not your question, but I think the show's better off without them, period.
Well, yeah. Can I jump in? I saw David Lee's adaptation not at Westport, but at the Two River Theater in Red Bank. A couple years ago. And if my memory serves, the revelers were basically only at the beginning. I wanted to see the show at Westport because, for several reasons, and I don't think I'm going to be able to make it. But it's interesting because when the show was done at Two River, and I think previously in another production in L.A., it was also directed by David Lee, who did the adaptation. But this one at Westport Country Playhouse is directed by Mark Lamos. And it sounds as if he has made additional changes. I really don't think that the revelers functioned in the same way at Two River. I just remember them in the beginning, and I don't think they intruded in Act Two like that. So I suspect you might have liked the show much better at Two River.
I have heard that that there was interest in seeing if this could be a stop before Broadway for this. Do you think that's is that a possibility? Do you think Robert Sean Leonard would be able to sell enough tickets?
I can't see this really quite on Broadway. It's certainly a nice divertissement in the Westport Country Playhouse. It's nice if you have a weekend in the country, you should include this. But no, I don't know. This is not the Broadway revival I'd want to see. And of course, if it came to Broadway, I'm sure that they'd augment the sets, which now is simply a backdrop of the castle and a tree, and occasionally, you know, things slide on like a bed and all that, but not very much. For those who know the history of Camelot and how Then You May Take Me to the Fair and Fire and Goodness were dropped as time went on, they're in this production, but a lot of characters have been dropped. There's no Merlin. There's no Nimue. There's no Morgan Le Fay. Yeah, Merlin is only spoken about.
One of my favorite songs, unfortunately, is gone. Follow Me.
Follow Me, yeah.
It's such
Follow
a beautiful song.
Yeah, it is, yeah, so...
All right. You also got to see End of the Summer. Peter, you got to see the end of Summer at the Metropolitan Playhouse. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a play by S.N. Behrman, who was a Boulevard playwright back in the 20s, 30s, 40s. Musical theater fans know him from writing the book To Fanny in 1954. But this is a play from 1936 that was a minor hit on Broadway. But my, does it pack a wallop at the Metropolitan Playhouse. First off, I'd like to say that this is a very valuable company to New York City. Artistic director Alex Rowe finds these plays from yesteryear and proves to us without a shadow of a doubt that they're worthy vehicles and they have something to say to today's audiences. And Alexander Harrington's production is quite solid as well. I mean, this is a situation where the more things change, the more they change, stay the same, because it starts off with a young man who's a college graduate recently talking to an older woman saying, you know, your generation had it easy. You people had all the opportunities, and our generation, we graduate from college and nothing happens to us. We can't get a job. And of course, that's what we hear all the time today. But this is 1936, and it's so interesting to know that this was going on way back then, too. As a result, this young man wants to be politically active. And the old woman doesn't really realize that he's really much more of a revolutionary. I don't mean a terrorist. I just mean somebody who wants to work in the system to enact some change. And he's going to have a magazine that's going to have a lot of these issues in it. And she's willing to back it, unaware that she's essentially sabotaging her own life, if indeed he were to be successful. If he were to be successful is an important value here. And the play really doesn't go into that much more after it establishes that. What it really is a type of love story, because this young man is there because he's in love with the granddaughter. And the question becomes, should a poor man marry a girl who's been astonishingly rich? As he's warned, when you marry a very rich woman, you live in her house. And that isn't just meant that physically you live in her house, but that you actually metaphorically live in her house, too, that she will have the power because she has the money. There are so many lines that really intrigued me. Why can't radicals be chic? And you may recall in the 60s and 70s, we had that expression, radical chic. So that was kind of interesting to me. There's a vogue today for sensational biographies. I like that line. I think that's true. So what must have been shocking back in 1936, too, is that a man who is courting a middle-aged woman suddenly gets more interested in her daughter. Now, that must have been haunt stuff at the time. Anyway, one of the themes is money can't solve the problems of girls and women who pick the wrong boys and men. And there's a really tremendous scene when, indeed, the man who has been interested in the mother but now is interested in the daughter must tell the mother that he's interested in the daughter. Yeah, there are fireworks there. So for people who think that a play from 1936 that wasn't that big a hit back then can possibly be forgotten or tired or not interesting at all, oh, go to the Metropolitan Playhouse and see End of Summer and you'll be proved wrong. I love this company. I am so grateful that it exists, and I wish it goes on forever and ever.
That's great to hear. So let's skip from the Metropolitan Playhouse to the Metropolitan Museum of Modern Art, where Michael got a chance to see Romeo and Juliet's 1968 film directed by Franco Zeffirelli.
Yes, I did.
Sports car driver.
Franco Zeffirelli. This film was a phenomenon in its day when it came out in 1968. And I wanted to mention it because I did see it last night, the 15th, at MoMA. And it was a brilliantly restored, I won't say print because it was digital. It looked absolutely gorgeous. The cinematography and the costumes are just amazing. This was so popular in its day. I don't think that there's anything like it that's ever happened before. As Peter mentioned before we started recording it, it wound up with a lot of kids seeing Shakespeare who never probably thought they would, because it was the cool and the most popular thing to do. I remember I guess maybe like a year or two later, I was in junior high school, and my English teacher brought in the soundtrack recording of the film, which again was so popular that they released the complete soundtrack on, I believe, two or maybe three LPs with obviously dialogue and music. And we, she had us listen to the recording while reading the play, because a great deal of it is word for word from the play. There's no rewriting. There's just some cuts. So that was extraordinary. I'm not sure if anything remotely similar has happened. There was the Leonardo DiCaprio, Claire Danes, Baz Luhrmann film of Romeo and Juliet, which I think achieved some popularity many years later, but nothing like this. And it's, honestly, so, and watching it now, some of it does not work that well. Some of it is very overwrought. Also, I don't know if you guys know this, and it sounds incredible, but apparently the entire film was looped after the fact, because in Italy in those days, that's how they made films. They would never or almost never record the dialogue while filming. Now, that's not easy to do, and there are some places in the movie where it's pretty obvious, but then there are other sections where it's really well done, especially some of the intimate scenes between Romeo, played by Leonard Whiting, and Juliet, played by Olivia Hussey, who both are, first of all, their acting is extraordinary for people who were so young. I think Olivia Hussey was still a teenager, and Leonard Whiting, if he wasn't, was just past it. They were both really young and incredibly beautiful and really, really related to the roles so wonderfully well. Milo O'Shea is also in it as Friar Lawrence, and Michael York is in the film as well. So it's an incredible time capsule of this incredible popularity of a Shakespeare film as one of the top films of its day.
Yeah, it was a big date movie. It really was. I mean, everybody I knew at the time was definitely going to see it. And the joke at the time was, Lord knows how many girls lost their virginity after it, because of course Juliet does in the show. And I remember hearing one guy saying that was the reason he was going to go. It was something I overheard on a subway, so I have no idea how he made out, but literally. And figuratively, but he thought this would be the magic potion, which is a much better potion than Romeo and Juliet take. But I hope I didn't give anything away. Anyway, wow. So anyway, yes, everything Michael says is 100% true about what it was like in its day, and it was great to see so many young people avidly going to see it.
So I guess that's the key to everything. You got to make it cool for the kids, and then the kids will go see it. So the last review of today for today is, Peter and I got a chance to go to the Paper Mill Playhouse and see the producers. So Peter, what did you think about the production?
Well, it's pretty much a carbon copy of the original, and that's not terribly surprising. Obviously, these are sets that came from a tour or maybe even the original production. So it's business as usual in terms of that. So if you saw the show 15 years ago, that went quickly. If you saw the show 15 years ago on Broadway, it's pretty much the same thing. Now, of course, the big difference is you don't have Nathan Lane and you don't have Matthew Broderick. Who you have is Michael Kostroff as Max, and you have David Josephsberg as Leo. Now, it's directed by Dawn Stevenson. Now, Dawn Stevenson played Leo in the National Company in the first national tour with Louis J. Stadlin playing Max. And I imagine that Dawn Stevenson was very good in this production because David Josephsberg is sensational in it. And let me explain why. I always felt that when Matthew Broderick was doing it, he was just too manic. Matthew Broderick has certainly made a career of playing manic, and with those tiny steps he takes and that stunned look on his face and all that. So David Josephsberg really plays it much more as a human being. Yes, he takes out the little blue blanket when he gets nervous. But when you think of it, so much in the dialogue has, if there is a voice of reason in the show, and I would not argue with anybody who says there's no voice of reason in the producers, but if there is a voice of reason, it would be Leo, who occasionally says, Max, we can't do that. Max, that won't work. You know, that type of thing. And because David Josephsberg plays Leo as a human being first, with a few childhood neuroses carried over from his youth, I think it's far more effective. You know, there are enough crazy people in the producers that you don't need another one. So under those circumstances, I was very impressed by David Josephsberg and the take that he had on the producers. So that will be one of the two things you will find differently. The other thing we might as well tell you now is that you may recall that the second act began with the curtain going up and Ulla having painted the entire office white. Well, that takes another set, doesn't it? And under those circumstances, well, you know, maybe it's better to drop that joke and just have her tidy up the place a bit. And that's what happens here. So don't look for the white set at the beginning of the second act. Competent, terrifically accomplished production. Those who missed the producers the first time around, and Lord knows they had plenty of opportunities to see it, might want to catch up. Those who were nostalgic for it might enjoy seeing it again. But it really is for the first timers. A great production for kids who weren't into theater yet, that they were infants 15 years ago, too young to go to the theater, and they heard about this show that won more Tony Awards than any other show in the history. So this is the time to catch up with it and see pretty much what it was like way back when.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there. It really was a tremendous carbon copy to what I'm remembering 15 years ago. I was a little disappointed in that. I really didn't think that they would copy every single aspect of it, but I really wanted to see if somebody had a new take on it, could find some new humor in it. But it was the same thing without without Nathan and Matthew. But David Josephsberg, if you closed your eyes, his voice sounded so much like Matthew Broderick, but he doesn't look like Matthew Broderick. So it was interesting for me to see that. And I misplaced my playbill, but the woman who played Ulla, and it was a couple of weeks ago, do you know who that actress was very, very good.
Yeah, I don't remember her name. By the way, I think David Josephsberg looks a great deal like Seth Rudetsky.
Yeah.
And I think if there's a revival of either The Boys from Syracuse or The Comedy of Errors, I'd cast them as Dromios.
So, yeah, so it was a fun time. It's playing for another week or so at the Paper Mill Playhouse. So if you have not seen The Producers or would like to go see it once again, get thee to Millburn, New Jersey. All right, so that kind of wraps it up for this week. Before we get on to trivia, and I know that you're all waiting for the trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. iHeartRadio plays us, Google Play, and anywhere else that you can find finer podcasts, you can find This Week on Broadway. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Now the moment we've all been waiting for. Peter, do you have an answer to trivia from 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, the question was, what was the first Broadway musical to mention the Beatles in any way, shape, or form? And I would say, you know, I was waiting for people to give me answers that would make me say, oh, that's right, I forgot about that one. Nobody did. The only person to get this was Donald Tessioni. And the answer that I can come up with is Skyscraper, a musical that came out in November of 65. Now, granted, that's almost 2 years from the Beatles' debut. I Want to Hold Your Hand came out on December 4th, 1963. So this was almost 2 years later. So if anybody wants to contradict me, I will certainly entertain any contradictions. But I think it was Skyscraper, which in a song called Local 403 did a great deal with Yeah, 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 which of course was a Beatles idiom based on the song She Loves You, not to be confused with She Loves Me, which I dare say is better, but that's another story. So that's the answer to that question, as far as I know. So if you have anything earlier than November 65, please let me know.
Well, I don't think 2 years is a long time for a cultural phenomenon to be reflected on.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, sure. But it's very possible I'm missing something. Yeah, I may wind up hearing something that makes me hit my head with a V8 type of slam, saying, oh, you're right, I forgot all about that. You know. So anyway, the new question. It closed as one of the 15 longest-running non-musicals in Broadway history. Its leading lady was acclaimed and Tony nominated for what she brought to it. But when the film version was made, she only got to be in a third of it. What's the name of the property and who's the actress?
Okay. So if you know the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. And next week we'll bring you the answer. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Shake a lucky break. Oh,